Welcome to Not Your Boyfriend's Sports Show. I'm Bryn.
And I'm Maeve. And this week on the show, March Madness winds down as the Masters get going, and the NFL hires its first female referee. Then our feature this week, women in sports journalism. How we got here and how far have we actually come? We'll discuss, plus we bring you another fierce lady. So let's do this. Bryn, tee it off. Who won March Madness?
Yeah, so to wrap up our college basketball season, on the men's side, Duke won over Wisconsin 68-63. And that comes after Wisconsin beat Kentucky, who was previously undefeated, in the semifinals, which was sort of an upset, although if someone was going to beat Kentucky, it was probably going to be Wisconsin. Anyways, the final was a really competitive game throughout, kind of an unlikely hero in Duke's Grayson Allen.
Love those.
he's a freshman who averaged less than 10 minutes a game throughout the season, but when two of Duke's highest players were in foul trouble, he came in and scored 8 points in 2 minutes.
Wow.
And led Duke to their win, basically.
And this was Coach K's 10th pick? No, that was on the
5th, I believe.
But his dynasty continues.
Yeah, I mean, he's dominant. And he's coaching the Olympic team. Like, he's the best coach we have right now. Yeah. On the women's side, speaking of coaches that are just dominating, UConn beat Notre Dame in the national championship 63-53, which was kind of a scrappy game.
Especially considering UConn had been blowing other teams out of the water.
Yeah, this was definitely not their prettiest win, but it was a rematch of last year's championship. That was UConn-Notre Dame as well, and UConn won again, giving Coach Gino Auriemma his 10th national championship at UConn. So that, I mean, while it's not a surprise, it's still a pretty amazing victory and legacy for Auriemma.
Well, I guess we'll see if next year they can make the women's bracket a little more competitive.
I mean, that would be nice, but I feel like UConn is going to be the favorite no matter what. But an interesting storyline out of the women's side is that Jewel Lloyd, who is a junior for the Notre Dame team, decided that she's going to enter the WNBA draft early.
Oh, wow.
Which is something that doesn't happen that often in the women's game, partially because they have different eligibility restrictions. So for the women's draft, they have to have their 22nd birthday fall within a year of the season. Okay. It's just like the men's draft, all they have to do is be 1 year out of high school to declare for the draft. So the women have to wait longer, and I think there's just less incentive to go straight to the pros. So.
Well, I've also heard that that is by design, because since it's less likely that women can make an actual athletic career out of basketball, they want their players to actually get use out of their college education, meaning finish their college education, which is so different from the men's side.
Right. And that makes a ton of sense, but there's also a ton of debate on the men's side of whether the one-and-done rule actually makes room for any education for the players who play 1 year in college and then go straight to the pros. So that's something that's being debated right now as to whether they're going to change that rule to make it more academic-focused or just let the men go straight from the high school to the pros.
Hmm.
So to be continued. But speaking of one and done players.
Are there some this year?
There are quite a few.
What a surprise.
Kentucky set the record for 7 players declaring for the draft from a single team.
And only 5 players start a basketball game. So more players than they actually field in a game.
Yeah, we basically just cleared Kentucky's bench.
Wow.
So Karl Anthony Towns, Willie Cauley-Stein, Trey Lyles, Devin Booker, Dakari Johnson, Aaron Harrison, and Andrew Harrison all declared for the draft from Kentucky this year. And it's just, I mean, there's no doubt that Kentucky's going to have some really great recruits coming in to replace them, but it's just insane to see the program that Calipari has set up that can make this kind of thing happen.
Right. And it's not like the NBA is easy pickings either. There's still so much competition there, so it'll be interesting to see how far these guys actually go.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, well, switching gears a little bit to the NFL, Sarah Thomas was named the first female official for the 2015 season.
Woohoo!
Woohoo! So she previously had reffed a bunch of college games, and she's been doing this for years. She also recently completed the NFL's officiating development program. And the timing of this, many see it as a move by the NFL to heighten the visibility of women in the game after last season's debacle and disastrous handling of the whole Ray Rice domestic abuse situation. But Thomas certainly has the experience. She's done the work. And interesting side fact, that reffing in the NFL is not a full-time job. So while she's also a mother of three, she continues to be a pharmaceutical sales rep.
Whoa. Yeah. Good for her. Has there been any pushback on this?
No, not so much. The one other interesting thing I read about it is that from her NCAA games, she got really used to tucking her ponytail under her hat as a way to make herself blend in more. And she says she's going to continue that in the NFL too.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, the one thing I saw was that John Harbaugh, the coach of the Baltimore Ravens, came out in support of her, saying that she was she had reffed some of their games and he was impressed with her. And so.
Yeah, she made some appearances reffing NFL games.
Like preseason or something.
And also when there was the referee union strike
right.
in a okay. previous season. But she's the first full-time official that the NFL has hired.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And then turning toward golf, this weekend, we're recording this on Sunday, this weekend is the Masters tournament held every year at Augusta National Golf Course. Jordan Spieth is trying to break Tiger Woods' all-time record at the Masters. He needs to beat 270 strokes over 72 holes of play. So one golf game is 18 holes. They play a series of games over the weekend. So in order to break Tiger's record, he needs to score under 270 total strokes over those 72
holes. And so far
holes.
It looks like he might be able to do it, right?
Yeah, he has a good shot. So maybe we'll do a little editor's note and let you know how that turned out.
In a couple hours.
Yeah. So it's more than a couple hours later, and I'm going to break in here with that editor's note. Jordan Spieth did end up winning the Masters. He's 21 years old, making him the second youngest winner ever of the tournament. Only Tiger Woods was younger when he won in 1997. Spieth ended up scoring a total of 270 over those 72 holes. This ties him for first, and he scored on Sunday a 70 to win his victory. Okay. Back to the conversation. There is no equivalent Masters tournament for women, and in fact, the men and women's tours are totally separate. They don't have concurrent tournaments like tennis. And Augusta, which is this really famed golf course where the Masters is held every year, just recently in 2012 admitted their first female member. They actually admitted two. It was Condoleezza Rice was one.
That's awesome.
And
that woman is everywhere.
She's
on the NCAA football selection committee as well.
She's a big sports fan, actually.
That's awesome.
And the other woman was South Carolina financier Darla Moore. So obviously the women in golf don't have this great platform, this historic platform that is the Masters Tournament. But they did last week have the ANA Inspiration Tournament, and Brittany Lincicome, I might be botching
that. I think that's right.
She upset Stacey Lewis to win the tournament. It's her second time winning. She won last in 2009.
Awesome.
Yeah. So I say let's take a break, and then we'll come back and talk women in sports journalism.
Sounds good.
Welcome back. You know, there's no doubt a lot of sports has lost its way, and I'm going to tell you part of the reason is because we've got women giving us directions. For some of you, this is going to come across as very misogynistic. I don't care because I'm very right. I'm willing to share my sandbox as long as you remember you're in my box. I didn't get into yours. I didn't all of a sudden slip into your world. You came into mine. If you like sports, you have to accept a certain amount of Neanderthal being served with it, all right? There are very few small handful of women who are any good at this at all. That's the truth. The amount of women talking in sports to the amount of women who actually have something to say is one of the most disproportionate ratios I've ever seen in my frickin' life. We're not changing a thing. It's a man's world. It's the last place where men will be men. It's the last place where guys do get away with locker room talk and being disrespectful. That's how you bond. That's how you have fun. This is guy stuff. This is men stuff. And I don't expect women to understand men stuff anymore. They should expect me to be able to relate to labor pains. Sports are set to the dial of men. Doesn't mean men only. But that's the setting, and I'm not going to allow it to be changed.
So that was Damon Bruce, a sports talk host in San Francisco.
And all around, just generally likable guy.
Just a great guy, you can tell off the bat. That clip is from 2013, and he was ultimately suspended for his comments. But that is just one example, and more recently, two Chicago radio hosts, Matt Spiegel and Dan Bornstein, they were called out for tweeting about a fellow Chicago sports reporter, Ayanna Crystal. They tweeted, "I have no interest in her work, but enjoy her giant boobs." And just to keep laying it on, Boston area sports talk host Kirk Minahane was suspended for calling Erin Andrews, a Fox sports reporter, a, quote, "gutless bitch who should drop dead."
Oh my God.
It gets better because in his apology, he said that if she were 15 pounds heavier, she'd be a waitress at Perkins.
What?
Yeah. So there seems to be a little bit of a release of some repressed masculine dominance going on in sports radio these days. But maybe we should go back to the beginning where the story starts, to the 1970s when women were just entering the world of sports reporting.
All right. So I guess the best place to start with that is with Robin Herman. Robin Herman was no stranger to trailblazing. She was part of the first class of women admitted to Princeton University in 1969.
Get it, girl.
Yeah. So then in 1975, she was a 23-year-old New York Times reporter, and she'd been trying to get the NHL teams to allow her and other female reporters access to the athletes in the post-game locker room. And had been trying for like a year with no success. When all of a sudden in the 1975 All-Star Game in Montreal, two coaches decided to allow the same access to everyone, marking a pretty pivotal moment in sports journalism.
Yeah.
But really, like, since it was an All-Star Game, the story of that day was about a woman being in the locker room. It wasn't really about the game. So it wasn't like they got an amazing story out of that. The story was about them, not about the game. And it took several more years for all the teams in the NHL to allow access to female reporters. But this instance made some waves throughout the industry, and it led to the Ludke Supreme Court case in 1978.
Yeah, so Melissa Ludke was another young sports writer for Sports Illustrated, and she was not granted equal access to the men's locker room during the 1977 World Series. And the reason that they gave her why she couldn't come in was that players' wives had not been granted approval, had not granted their approval, and their children would be embarrassed in school the next day. So a lawsuit was brought against this. And in 1978, a federal court granted equal access to female journalists. It's nowadays called the Melissa Ludke Rule. And she said about the whole experience, quote, "By the time the lawsuit fell in my lap, I wasn't a newcomer. It was not a crusade. I was just trying to do my job better."
So the whole reason was the kids at school would be embarrassed by a woman being in a locker room where presumably men are in towels? Or like, what was the...
Yeah, the wives hadn't granted permission. And the whole thing that is kind of ridiculous about this access to locker room thing is that you don't need to allow any reporters into locker room. You can do post-game interviews in a totally different place.
Yeah.
And yeah, there was a really funny quote. I forget who said it, but it was something like, I had to come up with all these logical reasons to be allowed in for what was ultimately could have been solved by just some really big towels.
I mean, that makes sense to me. Let's go the path of least resistance.
Well, it also seems in your example with Robin Herman that it was kind of just on the whim of those two coaches that she was allowed in. It wasn't even like an organizational decision.
And it wasn't an NHL-wide decision. She had to keep petitioning and asking for permission from all the teams throughout the entire season. So it's not like a pioneer from the top of the NHL made this decision and made it apply to everyone. This was like one by one working against the system.
And as these two examples show, just what goes in one sport doesn't necessarily count for all of them, and each league operates on its own agenda and decided at various points when it was appropriate for women to enter the locker room.
Totally. But jumping back to present day, the sexism in sports reporting isn't quite as blatant as it was in the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Amen.
But now it's coming up against some of the same structural and institutionalized issues that we see in just about every other arena, whether it's business, politics, or any other field. You know, the sexism isn't as cut and dry. People identify it as an issue and want to correct it, but we still see male executives at the top of all the industries. We still see this like inherent bias that prevents women from breaking through this glass ceiling.
Yeah.
So it's identified as an issue, but there aren't necessarily ways that we've figured out to get around it, whether that's policy or in practice.
Yeah, and one thing that a lot of the female sports writers talked about in terms of how this institutionalization of sexism is trying to be overcome is this idea of quotas. And whether quotas are explicit policy or not at some organizations is up for debate. But for the women, they said that it often works in their favor, but then it also leaves them with this lingering question of, was I hired because I'm good or because they needed to fill a quota?
Yeah.
And this idea of a quota then works against them in a different way, in that once organizations have a woman in place in a position, they don't feel compelled to have many more. So Jenny Vrentas, who's an NFL writer, she recalled one time when she and some other female colleagues were lamenting that these two women that everybody really respected and knew for their good work ethic had gotten passed up for jobs. And one was because the station wanted a blonde, and the other was because they already had a woman of her ethnicity. So
it's not like there aren't a million white males in sports reporting.
To that point, but also to what you were saying before, that this isn't unique to the sports industry. There was a Wall Street Journal article that was discussing a study by the University of Maryland that found that a woman's chance of landing one of the company's 5 highest paid executive jobs drops by 51% if there's already a woman on the team.
That's insane.
Yeah. So,
and kind of gets to like shine theory and like women need to be advocating for other women to succeed.
Definitely.
Because if you are that woman in the top job, then I feel like there's a certain responsibility for you to continue advocating for women who are coming up behind you.
Yeah, but kind of understandably, there's some territorial dynamics there because especially for kind of previous generations of women who had to get over a lot in order to get where they are, they become very protective of what they've achieved.
Totally.
And if they see an advantage to being the only woman, to having that quota and them being the one that filled it, then they might be a little more hesitant to, you know, throw the doors wide open, which isn't necessarily right, but maybe it's understandable given the circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, one of the reasons that is cited over and over again for women not achieving the top positions in sports journalism is this like totally undefinable thing where men are just like, we prefer to hear male voices doing play-by-play and color commentary. And it's really interesting to me because it's sort of this gut feeling. It's no one has a good reason for it, but it's just this like gut feeling that people have that they don't want to hear women's voices on the air going through sports. And it kind of reminds me of what we've heard lately about people talking about Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. And like, they can't really articulate a reason, but it's just like, she just rubs me the wrong way. You know, I just don't get on board with her. And that's not my personal opinion, but you hear that time and time again. And there have been lots of studies and op-eds about this type of thing coming from, you know, Sheryl Sandberg and the like, where there's this like unfounded but nevertheless really strong reaction against prominent female voices. Mm. And right now it seems like that's one of the biggest barriers that women sportscasters are up against, as well as women in all fields, is just this inherent negative reaction to them, whether or not they're doing the exact same job at the exact same level as their male counterparts.
And this reminds me a lot, actually, of a recent This American Life episode in terms of men just somehow not wanting to listen to a woman's voice.
Yeah.
And they talked about this thing called vocal fry, which is when your voice kind of gets a little crackly like this. And Ira Glass was saying that they have received so much mail from listeners talking about how they really dislike listening to the women reporters on the show. And so Ira Glass goes back and he listens to himself and the male reporters on the show. And he's like, I totally do it. They totally do it. But none of the mail that we receive has anything to do with the men. It's only the women.
That's so interesting. I mean, I'm sure part of it is just growing up that men are used to listening to men do the play-by-play. So like, it's always going to be a tough transition, but if there is no actual reason behind it that's definable, then like it's something we got to get over.
Definitely. That's get ridiculous. Over it fast.
Get over it right now. Another thing that came out in this whole discussion is, you know, there are so many male voices in sports journalism that are really distinguished, and like they have their own little idiosyncrasies, they have their own style.
Yeah.
And women, I read a psychology article about how women in sports journalism don't feel like they can give their own flavor to their reporting. They have to be like hyper professional. They can't really do the same like quirky catchphrases or joking around that men can do, or else they won't get the same respect that the men get.
Ugh.
Yeah. So there was one anecdote from Rachel Nichols, who's a CNN and Turner sports anchor, where she said that a male colleague of hers once called the San Francisco 49ers running back Frank Gore Al Gore. And everyone kind of like laughed it off and let it go because it was just a slip of the tongue that happens to everyone. But if a woman did the same thing, it would not have come off the same way.
Right.
So I think that's also a limiting factor for women in sports journalism, is that if they can't develop their own voice and their own style, then they're never going to be recognizable. They're never going to be that name that everyone knows based on their reporting. They're just going to be a purely objective and professional voice that you know, reports the news.
And so replaceable.
Yeah.
Which really reminds me of sideline reporters, which is one of the few places in sports journalism where women regularly are there and are talking and are kind of the stars of that little show. But these are also the women who are considered the most beautiful, and they also don't talk for very long. And a lot of what they do are more of the fluff stories, like injury reports or how did it feel to make that big play?
Yeah,
questions that have like an obvious kind of stupid answer.
Right. They're never really inserting any of their opinion or analysis into it.
Exactly. And some female reporters who are talking about this kind of phenomenon are like, well, they've been accepted there because viewers don't actually have to listen to them to enjoy the show. So imagine you're some like meathead man who's finished watching the big game, and now like, yeah, you'll look at a pretty girl on TV for the couple minutes afterwards.
Yeah, and it just breaks up like the male play-by-play people with like a pretty woman.
And that I remember when Pam Oliver got the boot in favor of Erin Andrews on Fox Sports. And it was a situation where both women are good at their jobs, but their looks were a hindrance for them in different ways, because Pam Oliver is quote-unquote old by industry standards.
Yeah, she was what, like 50 or something?
She's 54 years old, yeah. But Erin Andrews is constantly, you know, oh, she's too hot to be taken seriously. So It's just like, how do you win in this situation? And I think that this all actually ties into another interesting theme that came up while we were researching this episode, which is about beauty standards. And obviously there's a double standard between men and women on television. Think of all of the old, cripply, ugly, wrinkly guys who still are like balding in front of your face but get to tell you everything that you need to know.
Let's throw back to episode one. Chick Vitale is a prime example.
Exactly. But on the other hand, you know, women, you reach a certain age, you gain too much weight, you get pregnant. Like, there are so many things that happen where your appearance changes and all of a sudden it's like you're out. And none of this is unique to sports, but a recurring theme that came up was how other women in sports journalism, mostly writers and radio people, so people who aren't on camera, they really separated themselves from beauty as a way to prove that they were hired for their talent and not for their looks, which on the one hand is a really understandable impulse, but on the other hand, I think it reinforces this idea that women can't be smart and beautiful, no matter how unintentional these women meant those comments.
Yeah, so the women who are producing the content for like newspapers and writing about these things in depth are distancing themselves from the pretty faces that are the sideline reporters and
right.
that type.
Which delegitimizes the sideline reporters while simultaneously making them seem better.
Yeah.
And Kimberly Martin, who's a Jets writer for Newsday, I think she kind of summed it up. She said, "I'm just pointing out an obvious truth. Looks are at a premium when TV is involved. And that statement is almost 100% true when it comes to women. Trust me, I'm thrilled that so many women have been hired on major cable networks, but how many of them were first selected based on what's on their in their head versus what their face looks like?"
Yeah.
And just one more example, Amy Nelson, who's a pretty prominent sports journalist, she said specifically about sideline reporting, "It's so often populated with young, hot women who aren't actual journalists or reporters that it's become a cliche. It's our own female sports ghetto, akin to first base coaches in baseball or defensive back coaches in football, as the unofficially designated minority position."
Yeah, I mean, and that kind of goes back to the quota talk where, like, you're trying to fill this quota of women. And so if the women you bring in are just to fill a quota and maybe aren't the strongest option for that position, then it ends up just being a recurring cycle where you're like, oh, the female reporter wasn't good, but you were just bringing her in to fill a quota. You weren't bringing her in based on her talent. So
right.
It just kind of, it's a catch-22.
And just the larger issues of if all the executives and producers are men and then they kind of hire their own, promote from within, then, you know, of course women sort of get designated to these sideline positions. But I just thought it was an interesting dynamic that despite these women truly being mostly really supportive of each other, there was still kind of this subtext of like, well, she's pretty, so that's kind of, you know, a tick against her in my book because I had to get here like just on my talent.
Yeah. Well, in another way, some networks are trying to promote female sports reporting in a more concerted way. Specifically, CBS started a show called We Need to Talk.
Love it.
Which is the first nationally televised all-female sports show.
Oh, I love it. So punny. Like, we need to talk.
This is an issue. But it's interesting because it's not all about women's sports. It's sort of in line with what we're doing here, which is talking about all sports. Mm-hmm. It's just female-led. They have some really prominent hosts: Layla Ali, Ali Lafarge, Swin Cash, Dana Jacobson, Lisa Leslie, Dara Torres. Like, these are big names in women's sports over the last decade or so. And the camera women,
yeah.
All those producers, camera people, they're all women on the show. Like, it's CBS taking a stand and saying, we're going to put forth this female-specific show. It's not going to be based on ratings. They basically said from the start, we're going to order a couple seasons of this just to make sure that women are being pushed into these positions and put out in front of a large audience.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool. And the second season starts on April 28th at 10 p.m. Eastern time on CBS. So I'm looking forward to checking it out. I didn't see the first season at all.
Maybe we'll watch and do a little viewer review.
We could do that.
But this reminds me of this really cheeky little quote from Sarah Spain, who's a writer for ESPN. And she was responding to some of these criticisms that women aren't capable of actually being the full-time hosts of the sports talk shows. And she said, if we're going to generalize about gender, talking nonstop for hours and chatting on the phone is right in a woman's wheelhouse. But I digress.
That's amazing.
Like, Sarah Spain is my champion.
Yeah, that's incredible. I mean, why not? We love to talk. We love sports.
I mean, that's what we're doing right here.
Let's do it.
And then just that this criticism that, you know, women never play in these professional leagues like in the NFL and the MLB, things like that. And that's just such an empty argument to me because of the number of male sports broadcasters who never played either.
Right. Like saying that a female can't be a sports reporter for the NFL because she hasn't played, like, neither have most of the,
yeah.
I mean, there are a fair amount that have played, like quarterbacks and people who take these positions after their careers end, but like Bob Costas has never played.
Bob Costas is so well respected that he still got on the air during the Olympics last time around with pink eye. So,
and he was never an elite athlete.
I feel like if the bar is that low for men, then like, come on, we can't really make it that big of a hurdle for women.
Seriously.
But maybe to end on a more hopeful note, Amy Lawrence, who's a sports reporter, to tie it back to the beginning and that Damon Bruce clip we played.
Lovely.
She wrote a nice response to it, and she was talking about how could Damon Bruce or other men in the sports industry possibly not think that I'm tough because I've been through the harassment. I've been trying to beat the odds my whole career. I've been trying to break a glass ceiling that doesn't exist for them. And she said, basically, like, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And she said, I wouldn't know how to choose my battles, nor would I appreciate the beauty of the breakthrough.
Aw.
Yeah.
Good for her.
So, anyway, we're trying to do our part here at Not Your Boyfriend's Sports Show. So, when we come back, we'll be bringing you our next fierce lady.
So, fierce ladies.
Fierce ladies.
This week's fierce lady is a little bit bittersweet. We're talking about Lauryn Hill, who was a basketball player at Mount St. Joseph, which is a Division III university in Cincinnati, Ohio. Shortly after her 18th birthday, Lauryn was diagnosed with an inoperable brain tumor. But she always wanted to play basketball in college, so she decided to persevere and go play at Mount St. Joseph. And basically her condition started to deteriorate, and they petitioned the NCAA to make an exception for the team to move up their first game mm-hmm. so that she could play and have it be a moment where her family gets to come out and yeah. see her play in a college game. She ended up making the first and last points of the game, which like a really sweet story, and immediately went viral
yeah.
on BuzzFeed and everything. So Lauryn, I mean, she was just like the strongest, most amazing girl throughout this past year. Since her diagnosis, she began advocating for cancer research and sharing her story, and raised over $1.5 million for the Cure Starts Now Foundation.
Wow.
So she shared her story. Lots of celebrities have been picking up on it. LeBron James has been tweeting at her encouragement. But sadly, Lauryn passed away this week from her condition at 19 years old. But her story is just this incredible, inspiring story of a girl who was, you know, battling a condition that no one wants to deal with, like
yeah.
really horrible, but made the most out of it and inspired so many people, worked tirelessly to advocate for cancer research, and I can only imagine that $1.5 million is going to just skyrocket after all of the publicity and everything that's been coming from her story. So,
well, it's definitely admirable that in her last, what was it, year and a half between her diagnosis and her passing away, that she decided to dedicate her time to raising awareness and raising money. Because it could be so easy to just want to cherish, you know, moments with your family, moments with your friends, so.
Yeah, it definitely seems like she was just one of the most selfless people
yeah.
ever. So,
well,
here's
to
you, Lauryn.
Sports making a difference, yeah.
So that was a little bit bittersweet, but we are honoring Lauren's memory today on Not Your Boyfriend's Sports Show.
And if you want to get involved, we'll post a link to our page about where you can donate or learn more about the disease so that hopefully there can be enough research behind this to finally eradicate it and all sorts of cancers.
So that's Not Your Boyfriend Sports Show for this week. You can find us on Facebook at Not Your Boyfriend Sports Show, on Twitter at NYBF Sports, on Instagram at NYBF Sports, and on Gmail. You can email us at nybfsports@gmail.com.
And we're also on iTunes, Not Your Boyfriend Sports Show, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. Whichever way you want to listen, we'll be there.
All right. Good game, Maeve.
Good game, Bryn.